Welcome back to part three of Angela Bassett, Good, Bad, Crazy. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Brian, we've just seen a strange film.
Very strange, very Baroque, very dystopian, and yet another Angela Bassett movie from the year 1995.
Yeah, Bish Bash Bosh. So this concludes Angela in 95.
So let's think for a minute. So Waiting to Exhale is the bish, because it has four bishes in it.
It does, yeah.
Vampire in Brooklyn was clearly a bosh. It was a complete and utter bosh.
Yeah, a load of old bosh.
And this movie, in its hyper-violence from director Kathryn Bigelow, is clearly the bash.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bashing.
So it's so funny. Whenever you say Kathryn, I immediately assume the word following it is going to be Hepburn. Just because that's, you know, what you're like.
Do you remember my Katharine Hepburn impression from the previous installment?
No, but are you going to do it again
now?
It was
when you were demeaning George Cukor, and whenever you demean him, I'll have to rise to his defense, because I am an oak tree.
Do you think I'm being homophobic?
You're a self-hating gay. All right, now, Sean, before we talk...
Self-cleaning gay as well.
He's got a bun in the oven, folks. Okay, Sean, before we talk about Strange Days, I think you had a little kind of reflection overall about what this experience, this trip down 1995 memory lane, has been like for you.
Yeah, you know, 1995 was the first year that I have memories from. I have a distinct memory of being in 1995 and knowing that it was the year 1995. So I would have just turned five-ish.
Okay, that's not really having a memory.
No, it's not.
Explain it in more detail.
Okay, it's about awareness, as in, like, I had my first understanding that years existed.
Okay. How old would you have been? Six?
No, I would have been five.
Okay.
I would have been turning six, but I would have been five.
Okay.
Yeah. Back to the actual point at hand.
Uh-huh.
While we were off mic, for those mere minutes we were off mic between part two and part three, I was saying that I think this has been one of the most enjoyable broad appeals that I have done in recent memory.
Despite the eye-gouging banality and horror of Vampire in Brooklyn. Can you explain this, unpack it a little bit more? Is it just because of your newfound love of Angela Bassett? Is it because of the three films in particular?
First of all, it's not newfound love, okay? It's renewed love. If you go back to Broad Appeal Episode 3, and I saw that film, What's Love Got to Do With It, when I was too young to see it, really. And it made a huge impression on me, and she did, more importantly. So I've always loved Angela Bassett. But in particular, because these are three films from the same year, I think these roles encapsulate everything about her, you know, from Waiting to Exhale to Vampire in Brooklyn to this. Like, they're all one and the same film.
That's absolutely not the case. Let me try to say what I think you're saying, which is that it's hard to think of three movies that a single person could have made in a single year that could be more different. They're actually not the same film at all, Sean.
Interesting.
I mean, think about a woman making these three films in one year, right? A huge financial success, a kind of populist, weepy, romantic drama, then a kind of complete misfire, violent horror comedy, and then this outrageous, incredibly over-budgeted, and yet visionary dystopian sci-fi, all with one incredibly newly emergent black female star at the center. Angela Bassett in 1995 was having a moment that is very clear. If this episode doesn't fill me with quite as much joy as it fills you, it's because, like, I'm thinking to myself, 1995 was an awful long time ago. Why wasn't Angela Bassett allowed to stretch all these muscles every single year?
Yeah.
It's making me kind of amazed, as we've seen with Vampire in Brooklyn and Strange Days, she was allowed to take crazy risks and do things that, you know, you wouldn't expect her to have been put in. And I guess we should be happy that she did.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, overall, we should be happy.
Now, am I right, Sean, that when we were planning what films we would talk about, Strange Days was a movie that you had never even heard of?
Yeah, I had never even heard of it. Because
not the title, not anything.
No, I really don't. I mean, I've heard the word strange and days, like, in a sentence, you mm-hmm. know?
I mean, when you hear the word days, you think, like, Days of Thunder, or things like that. And when you hear the word strange, you think, like, Strange Interlude, Eugene O'Neill, right?
Yeah, and I just thought, Strange Days, I've heard of that. You know, I just hadn't heard of it. And, you know, when it comes to choosing actresses for this series, or for any broad appeal, really, you know, we look at their whole filmography, and with some people it's like, oh, of course we talk about this, this, and this, because it's an embarrassment of riches. And for some people it's like, oh, you know, I hope there's enough material for us to form a cogent kind of discussion. But in the case of Angela Bassett, as you said a few moments ago, it's because this particular year had these films in it.
I have heard of Strange Days for a long time. I had never seen it, even though I was around in the mid-90s. I was high school, middle schooler. I've kind of always in my mind associated this movie with things like Repo Man and what's that one with Sandra Bullock and is it Sylvester Stallone?
Demolition Man.
Yeah, Demolition Man, Repo Man, and Strange Days. For me, they're all this kind of like 90s, let's take the present day and kind of ramp it up into this extreme hyper dystopian world that involves technology and like millennial fears, you know, like Francis Fukuyama, it's the end of history, like, you know, Clinton era, we're contemplating that like nothing could get worse than it is now and we're just gonna put it all in a blender and have a lot of worries about what the future brings.
Also, cloning
and virtual reality were very, very hot button topics in those years.
You know, I was obsessed.
Gattaca,
of course. Mm. Yes, remember those two? So happy they were. I remember a subplot. This is only a milder version in Lois and Clark: The Adventures of Superman, in which clones of people were out there. But how you could tell that someone was a clone was because they ate live frogs, okay? Clones eat frogs. You know, the 90s was actually a very paranoid decade, but it wasn't paranoid in the same way that, like, the 80s were, the 70s were decades before, where it's about, like, you know, an external force like communism or the Soviet Union or whatever. It's more kind of a paranoia about the technology that we're inviting into our lives that we have created and what it is going to do to us.
In some ways, sci-fi always has, or often has, this kind of cautionary tale quality to it. It's like, basically, Black Mirror, right, makes a whole series out of this. And in some ways, if anybody's seen the Black Mirror episode from season one, where the people have the video chips implanted in their heads that, like, take a recording of everything they do in their lives, and it causes all this strife and domestic drama, in many ways, Strange Days anticipated that very premise in 1995. I had always thought that this movie was fundamentally just, like, a dystopian anti-tech kind of action thriller. It is so much more. It is so surprising. This movie, I was really not prepared for the amount of ideas and provocations that are just crammed into it. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah.
Now, we don't necessarily know, everyone out there in broad appeal land, if you just like listening to us talk or upon hearing our conversations, do you go and seek out the movies and actually watch them? I suspect very few of you have ever seen Strange Days. Sean, what would you tell people to do in terms of this film?
Well, first of all, I would really recommend you to see it. Second of all, I'd tell you to prepare yourself for content that is still pretty shocking, violence that will make you go, what the fuck? And a kind of dystopian future that would make Paul Verhoeven go, wow.
Let's be honest, after maybe 5-10 minutes of this movie, you were bug-eyed with glee, right? This movie pushes all the Sean type of buttons.
Yeah.
As it was going on, I looked at you and I said, oh my god, this movie has Sean written all over it.
It's funny because I don't know what a Sean movie is.
Oh, I do.
Yeah? What is the Sean movie?
Sean movie has elements of political allegory, hyper-violence, and auteurist stylization. And if you put in at least one badass woman, then Sean is there and the jizz is flowing.
Well, that's why I love Total Recall, because you get the great Rachel Tocotin and Sharon Stone.
We're talking Total Recall here. We're talking basically the entire filmography of Paul Verhoeven, right? Yeah, all the way leading up to Elle, which basically essentially is a sci-fi thriller in itself and is set in the world of violent video games. Anyway, this movie pushes all your buttons. It's not the type of thing that I generally love. The only kind of sci-fi that I typically love is more morose and melancholy. Things like Children of Men, you know, that kind of have a less agitated temperament.
That's a very nice way to put it.
Thank you. But the thing in this movie that I was completely unprepared for was its high degree of political commentary about American structural racism. Mm. Even having watched maybe 35, 40 minutes of the movie, it suddenly takes this big turn where it's not just about tech and kind of action. It is really about American race relations in the immediate years following the Rodney King beating, the LA riots that ensued, and just kind of a hypercharged atmosphere of police brutality in America.
Well, this is why I thought you'd chosen this.
I had no idea this was an element of the film, and it kind of makes it a fascinating, flawed, and yet incredibly potent document.
Well, this is, I think, why I would implore listeners to go and seek it out, because it's entirely 90s, but, you know, while the LA riots were a significant moment in American history in the 90s, I kind of feel that in the last few years of police brutality amongst people of color, and especially the fact that there's so much footage of that out there, you know, on police cameras, on cell phones, and whatever, I feel that we're kind of, you know, America as a nation, but also internationally, able to recognize what police brutality and structural racism looks like. I would be keen to see what an ordinary viewer of this would think about, you know, its politics now.
It's interesting that you say that, because when the LA riots, or rebellion, however you want to call it, were happening, when the OJ decision that followed a few years after that, I was living in a mostly white suburban Massachusetts area where, you know, in any kind of middle school, high school civics class or history class, these debates and these topics would come up because they were the big stories on the news. And it was kind of like, is there ever a justification for riots breaking out? Yeah. Like, you know, what is the role of the police in policing black communities? The responses of politicians to things like violent gangster rap, and what Bill Clinton said about Sister Soldier and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Two Live Crew. Also, you know, just Bill and Hillary and the crime bill and all that stuff. That was the kind of stew that we were living in. And I can remember having classroom debates with people just saying, like, well, they should let the police come in and law and order. And if you've seen, you know, Ava DuVernay's documentary, The 13th, like, she, I think, really charts how there was this upsurge in this kind of racial tension as a topic that was being discussed in the 90s in my adolescence. Now, what's fascinating about this film is that it's made by two white people who are not known for being the most politically astute people in Hollywood. Ooh. I'm talking about screenwriter James Cameron and director Kathryn Bigelow.
Just a side question. Where did you watch the O.J. verdict?
In Dr. Dower's physics class at the Roxbury Latin School.
I knew it. You watched it in school.
Of course you did. It was the biggest story of the year, of the decade. Like, the interesting thing is, like, you think of Ferguson and these recent situations that have come in the last couple of years as, you know, being defined by footage. Well, there was footage of the Rodney King beating, and that was why it was such a flashpoint, because despite the footage and the evidence, these cops were still acquitted. And so, in many ways, Strange Days, with its element of video footage being used as evidence of violence or I mean, it anticipates so much, right? Maybe we should start to explain what the premise of this future world that's envisioned is. First of all, the movie is actually taking place in Los Angeles, yeah? Just before New Year's in the year 1999. So if you think about it, it's a vision of only 4 years into the future from when the movie was released. But can you just describe what Los Angeles has become in the vision of James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow?
So Dan, you're looking forward to the new year?
Not really. I mean, what's the point? Nothing changes New Year's Day. The economy sucks. Gas is over $3 a gallon. Fifth grade kids are shooting each other at recess. The whole thing sucks, right? What the hell are we celebrating?
Okay, I'm gonna start by saying that this is a very convoluted plot. Los Angeles is a completely crime-ridden police state,
mm-hmm.
with riot police just on the street, violence everywhere, it's polluted, it's dirty.
It's always night, it's never day.
Yeah, again, it's always night. You know, it's one of those places that you can actually imagine is a lot of fun in some ways, like those clubs are pretty outrageous.
Well, I don't know if this is your idea of fun, but you love Paul Verhoeven movies. I mean, like, essentially, early on, we see Ralph Fiennes, who is the male lead of the film, like, riding in a car through these violent streets, and, like, Santa Claus is on the street being, like, gangbanged and carjacked. There's, like...
Gangbanged? Like, fucked on the streets?
No. I meant, like, attacked by gangbangers.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Okay, he's being, like, mugged and violently assaulted, Santa Claus.
Yeah.
You know, Saint Nicholas.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are Asian-American shopkeepers who have got rifles. There's, like, literally tanks rolling down the streets. There's barricades. It's fueled by drugs. It's ridden with graffiti. And you're just thinking, like... And this is where...
Why the neighborhood's really on the up.
Well, this is where I'm getting to, like, James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow's, like, weird white vision here. Because it's like, yes, they are motivated, we learn, by a desire to show the way that there's an all-encompassing police state that is based on systemic violence. But, like, this movie is, like, the nightmare vision. You know when Donald Trump talks about Chicago,
yeah.
right? And he talks about Chicago as being this, like, hellhole full of crime that,
yeah, the police,
you know,
won't go into.
That people don't have human yeah. lives. They just live in, like, a complete state of anarchy. What we see on the screen in Strange Days is probably what Donald Trump sees in his nightmare
God.
Visions when he thinks about, you know, the south side of Chicago. Would you agree?
Oh, God, yes. But in terms of the plot, okay, so that is the world we live in.
Yeah.
Ralph Fiennes plays this character called...
Lenny.
Yes, and Lenny, he used to be on the force, and now he was dismissed and whatever. And now what he does is he sells this thing called squid discs to people, and they jack into this kind of virtual reality thing.
They tap into people's actual cerebral cortexes.
Yeah, so these are memories of people. So, and how you do it, so I wear a little hairnet, essentially, and it records everything that I'm seeing right now, and that gets implanted onto a disc, and then Brian could put this little hairnet on, put the disc into a little drive, and he can relive exactly what I relived, but feeling it entirely and being completely me. So it's like VR meets, like, you know, Second Life meets...
Yeah, I mean, the idea of it is that it's such a visceral experience. There's a fun scene where we watch Rafe introduce some kind of buttoned-up yuppie businessman who's never jacked in. Isn't that what they call
jacked
it?
In, yeah.
He's never jacked into a squid yet. And they say to him, he says to him, like, you can try anything. What are you into? Getting with a girl? Getting with a guy? Being a girl?
Now listen, I want you to know what we're talking about here, okay? This is not like TV, only better. This is life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's pure and uncut. It's straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there. You're doing it. You're seeing it. You're hearing it. You're feeling it.
What kind of things, exactly?
Exactly anything. It's whatever you want, whoever you want to be, okay? I mean, you want to go skiing without leaving your den, you can. But I'm assuming that a guy like you, you want to go skiing, you fly to Aspen. That's not what you're interested in here. It's... about the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit, Like running into a liquor store with a .357 Magnum in your hand, feeling the adrenaline pumping through your veins, Or, you see that guy over there with the drop-dead Filipino girlfriend? Wouldn't you let it be that guy for 20 minutes? The right 20 minutes? Yeah, and I can make it happen, and you won't even tarnish your wedding ring.
And then we watch him put the thing on, and he goes through this, like, orgasmic experience of, like, living in someone else's body. And then Rafe says to him something like, yeah, you were just an 18-year-old girl having a shower. So the idea is that, like, it's this ultimate substitute for sexuality, heroin, drugs. It's, like, the ultimate high, which is the high of, like, experiencing someone else's life and perspective, and particularly violence and sex.
It is amazing because you know for a fact that if this existed, this is what it would be.
Remember that in 1995, we are before the time we live in now where everything is being recorded, where people are kind of walking around with video cameras essentially in their pockets. It's before these kind of really intense VR technologies that we now live in, the kind of immersive gaming and stuff like that. So in many ways, this movie is very, very prescient about the direction that we are moving in terms of video culture, right?
Mm.
There's this black market for this stuff, right? Like, people like Ray Fiennes' character, Lenny, they basically know, okay, there's going to be a real market for sex, violence, insane experiences that people don't want to have in real life, but they want to live as if they've had them.
Yeah. And that's why the first sequence in the film where you're looking at it through, like, it's like a first-person shooter, like a video game, where you're looking at this really violent robbery happen. At the end of the first scene, the guy jumps from one building to another, but he misses it, and he basically hits the ground, and he dies. The video ends, and we see Ray Fiennes pulling it off, and he's like, geez, I didn't know this was a snuff film.
Yeah, I don't trade in snuff films.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Ray Fiennes, he's looking young, he's looking lovely. I think we forget what a sex symbol he was in the mid-90s.
I just associate him with period dramas and Harry Potter and...
Not at all.
I know, but...
Period dramas and Harry Potter. Yeah. So you picture him as having no nose. No, I mean, he was hunky, you know, the English Patient.
But he was burned. He was a burn victim in that, wasn't he?
Not in the main part of it.
Which were just memories, weren't they?
They are memories told to Academy Award winner Juliette Binoche.
Yes.
And I'm going to say it because it's going to make certain listeners very happy. The heart is an organ of fire. The heart is an organ of fire. I love that. I believe that.
Perfect, Brian.
Thank you very much, Oscar Clip. Okay, moving on. So, Rafe is lovely, but he's very seedy. He wears these kind of polyester suits and ties and, you know, garish pastel colors. He basically looks like a kind of a pimp or a drug dealer, and the thing that he's pushing is this violent video technology, yeah? I think if we try to explain blow by blow, point by point, the plot of Strange Days, we will just tie ourselves in knots and we'll waste time.
And it won't be, you won't be able to follow it and it won't make any sense.
Like, it's clearly riffing on kind of film noir, right?
Yeah.
Where we have a kind of seedy, disreputable male character who was maybe like once in the force but has like fallen into the wrong circles, and he's going through these many layers of vice and corruption, and we're following it, we're seeing it through his eyes. He's interacting with pimps and clients and chanteuses and former flames and like trying to deal with the cops, and he's on the run. So it's playing
lots of that.
With those tropes. Yeah.
So who's Angela in the
film?
Well,
this is the question, and I was immersed in the world. I was enjoying the kind of crime aspect of it, like Rafe being on the run and all this, and I was thinking Kathryn Bigelow has directed the shit out of this movie. But I don't think it's a lie to say that like 30-ish minutes go by and Angela is nowhere to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because there's a lot of movie before there's a movie.
There's a lot of world building before the plot kicks off.
Which I am actually totally fine about.
Okay.
I know that in other films you'd be like, oh my god. But because this world is so mental, with Santa Claus getting, like, fucked in every hole on the street, you know?
And also, Juliette Lewis frequently stripping and being, like, nearly nude.
Or nude.
Yeah, I mean, who is she?
Okay, without going into it too much, Juliette Lewis is the ex-girlfriend of Ralph Fiennes. She is so good. Brian said that this could have been a role for Madonna to play, and I said she was too old, and then, like, another 45 minutes in, I was like, you know, Sandra Bernhard could have played this role, and he was like, babe, if Madonna was too old, so is Sandra.
Well, why recast it, though? Because you think that Juliette Lewis was actually very good.
Well, Juliette Lewis reminds me a bit of Sandra Bernhard, you know? Mm. She's kind of, like, just pissed off, man.
She plays a character called Faith. And Ralph Fiennes still has faith in her, but she was like a young innocent who loved him, and he still watches the squid videos from their lovemaking. But she's now fallen in with a disreputable music executive named Philo.
Yeah.
And she basically walks around wearing, like, you know,
scales.
Like, yeah, almost no, yeah. You know, just, it's more skin than clothing.
It's like, back off away from me, man.
And she,
I told you not to come around here, buddy.
And she sings in, like, warehouse nightclubs, and, you know, Rafe still clearly wants to get back with her. There's a whole mysterious plot that involves this kind of other woman named Iris, who is basically a call girl who's been beaten up and on the run and is trying to get some information to Rafe about danger. There's also been the killing of a prominent rapper.
Yeah, Tupac stand-in.
Yeah, his name is Jericho.
Yeah.
And who's he played by?
He's played by Christopher Plummer. Glenn Plummer.
It'd be I heard actually that James Cameron tried to reshoot the film later with Christopher Plummer stepping in.
Just for no reason, really. Plummer.
Who is Glenn Plummer?
Glenn Plummer, dear Brian, dear listener, he was in Showgirls. I can't remember his character's name, but he was the black guy, you know?
Who gets with
Naomi Malone.
Mm.
He's one of the few people who's actually not a complete beast of a human, you know?
Showgirls.
A complete monster, yeah.
And in this one, he's kind of...
James, that's who he plays.
Okay, there we go. Well, in this, his character of Jericho is a gangster rapper, but one who has real political content in his lyrics and mostly kind of critiques of the police.
Yeah. About to grow from the seed you sowed. You fertilized it with comedy. You routed it with dope. And Hollis hit by the guns that betrayed my hope. But scopes came with them guns. Now what do I see? You and your family looking scared of me. You plead mercy. But nonviolence has only got me halfway to where I want to be. Now my vengeance will make me free. So don't throw Martin Luther King in my face. His dream's no reality. Fatality's the case.
And we see these kind of news clips of him saying, you know, the police are a military force that have been turned against their own people, and he's been shot, and he's been killed.
Yeah.
And
so everything's about to pop off.
Yeah, all of this has happened before the action proper gets going, but the killing of this rapper, Jericho, is going to become crucial to the way the plot runs.
And that's all we should say about
that.
Okay. So who is Angela?
Well, that's the whole stew of everything, and then in comes a limousine driven by Academy Award nominee Angela Bassett, playing the role of, I believe, Lornette Mason.
Yeah.
Now, okay.
Lawyers.
Okay, I'm going to say this about Angela Bassett. Like, this character makes no sense to be performed by anyone other than Angela Bassett, because it basically combines every conceivable Angela Bassett archetype into one quote-unquote character, okay?
Mm-hmm.
She's essentially a hard-working, hard-driven businesswoman, a mother, a former waitress, a kung fu expert, and just, like, a badass chick in leather who also is, like, incredibly emotional and sensitive.
Yes.
She is all these things in one, okay?
That is Angela Bassett's entire filmography.
And at the beginning, I was thinking to myself, okay, so she's driving this limo. She clearly knows Rafe, because, like, Rafe kind of needs to get somewhere because his car has been towed. And she's driving around this Japanese businessman, right? They go into the nightclub. So she's always kind of on the outskirts, like, picking Rafe up, taking him from place to place, not wanting to get drawn into this web of crime that he's involved
in. Yeah, like, she shouldn't be getting involved, but she is, and you're like, why? What's going on here?
She's a single mother. She's got a kid named Xander back
very cute
home. Adorable little boy. yet she keeps being involved in these things, and he needs her to, like, drive the getaway car and, like, take him to someplace so that he can investigate what exactly is the crime that's going on with this whore Iris and all this stuff.
This whore Iris.
Well, that's what her name is. But honestly, I have to say, James Cameron has written some really great screenplays, right? I mean, you probably think that Aliens is one of the best movies ever made, I suspect. And I mean, I will never forget that amazing speech that he wrote for Sigourney Weaver in Avatar about the missing element unobtainium.
Yeah.
So, you know,
worst screenplay ever.
Okay.
I mean, we all know you're being sarcastic.
I am being sarcastic.
But it is a terrible, terrible screenplay.
James Cameron has written some very good screenplays. He can sometimes be maybe in need of an edit, shall we say. This movie is all over the map in terms of plot and content and the things he's trying to ram in. Now, didn't we do the math and determine that when this movie was made, James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow were divorced?
Yes, they were already divorced.
So who knows when he wrote it? It may have been in development for a long time, but they had been married, and by the time she ended up directing it, she was his ex-wife.
Did he produce it?
I don't know if he produced it, but he wrote the thing. I mean, he's clearly got some involvement in it.
Well, remember when they were nominated in the same year for Best Director, and there was that great picture of him, like, trying to wring her neck?
No.
No?
That sounds awful. I just remember Tina Fey and Amy Poehler's joke about them at the Golden Globes, which was...
There's been a lot of controversy about Zero Dark Thirty, but when it comes to torture, I trust the woman who spent 2 years married to James Cameron.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, like, knowing that this was made by ex-partners Catherine and James, I couldn't help but start reading into the relationship between Ralph Fiennes and Angela Bassett, because, spoiler alert, and I really mean this as a spoiler, it sort of emerges very, very late and slowly in the film. Angela is kind of in love with Rafe. I mean, more than kind of. She sort of says she's in love. So while Rafe is pining after elusive Shantuzi Juliette Lewis, right, who really seems like not worth his time, at one moment Angela Bassett, like, bursts in and says, "Why are you wasting all your time with that toxic waste bitch?" You know? And, like, you realize, oh my god, she's carrying a torch for Rafe. So why is it? What is their history?
Oh my god, I just realized, okay? So, Angela Bassett is Catherine Bigelow. Rafe is, what's his name?
James Cameron.
And Juliette Lewis is Linda Hamilton.
Whoa.
Yeah.
We've unlocked the key to all mysteries.
That's it, yeah.
It's the Kabbalah here, folks. And we've unlocked the code.
And what's her name? Iris is Gail Ann Hurd.
I don't know who that is, and I really don't want to know. Can we stay focused on the movie, please?
Yes.
So, what is Angela's history with Rafe? We learn in the flashbacks.
Well, we learn that, he was a cop, and we see this flashback in which her no-good husband is being dragged out and put in jail, and she walks into her house to see...
Dressed him. As?
Dressed as a waitress, mm-hmm. with totally different hair, waitress hair.
And I mean, like, 50s waitress 50s, hair.
Yeah, the child
it could have been a still from The Help.
Child is only fractionally younger, you know? It could have been a still from The Help.
And this is what I'm saying about this character not making any sense. So she's like a kind of, you know, South Central LA working class woman with a kid. Her husband gets into jail. Somewhere between having been that waitress to the moment that we see her in this post-apocalyptic world, she has not only started her own entrepreneurial business as a, like, high-tech, armor-plated limousine driver and security consultant, but she has also apparently learned, like, kick-ass kung fu skills. She can, like, shoot a rifle. Like, where did she learn all this stuff?
What was that film we saw where the person wanted to be a caterer? Was that Waiting to Exhale? It's like, I'm gonna get my catering license, you know?
Was it Monster in Law?
I don't know, but, like,
I don't know what film you're talking about.
It takes less time to learn kung fu than it does to become a caterer, you know?
Well, you know.
You heard it here first.
There's a lot you have to learn in those food hygiene classes. So Angela has become this kind of badass entrepreneurial woman, but she is in love with Rafe because Rafe helped her and her son through this difficult period. So I think the movie doesn't quite make sense because it really does elide this period of time where Rafe somehow turned into a, like, pimpy dealer selling illicit videos, and she somehow became an action-oriented driver. Like, that is all fascinating. I'm not sure that I really buy the connecting the dots from that flashback to what we're seeing in the movie.
But that's fine.
I know. Okay. So, I know we're not going to talk about the plot, but can we talk about some of the, like, insane set-piece scenes that are either hyper-violent or just, like, balls-to-the-walls crazy in terms of action? Where to begin? Well, how about Iris, the aforementioned whore? She is she is no longer alive about halfway through the movie.
Yeah, we introduced her just running, like, you know, down the stairs of public subways with these police after her, and everybody's beaten and bloodied and sweating and, you know, scared for their lives, and she runs onto like a public train, and they shoot through the window, and they like beat her, and they grab her hair.
She has her toes cut off.
She has her toes cut off.
Previous, like, run-in with a train track. Yeah, that's run over her toes.
She rushes to the bar where Lenny is, and she's like, "I'm in deep trouble, man," and blah blah blah. He doesn't help her, but she does get sent by her boyfriend to a hotel for the night. Okay, just to recover, whatever. And then comes one of the graphic set pieces that we get to see repeated a bit later on. It's all from the first person. It's like Squid, and this person enters her hotel room, blindfolds her, chains her to a radiator, okay, puts a squid thing on her head that doesn't record her memory, but connects to the view the person has, so sees through the eyes of the perpetrator, okay, who is choking her to death, raping her, and going about to, like, knife her with a Stanley knife.
Now, if Sean's description of it hasn't conveyed, this is a truly gruesome and painful, and it's not even so much that it's showing a lot of gore.
Yeah.
It's just the tension and the...
It's inhumanity of it.
Inhumanity in the sense of exploitation of, like, not just a horrific act of sexual violence, but one where he's tapped what he's seeing into her head and that she's watching from his perspective while it's happening to her.
Like, that is some human centipede shit.
It is this, like, deep, dark, horrific thing that is at the center of this movie. Like, Rafe watches this and says, we have to find out who has done this to Iris. He feels, I think... you know, upset that he didn't help her, that he didn't listen to her when she came to talk to him. And I think increasingly he and Angela become worried that these same people who did her in are part of a vast conspiracy that is going to come after them.
Yeah.
Now, so they're on the run trying to put the clues together of who this murderer of Iris is. They also then uncover some dastardly deeds by two truly awful, horrific, inhumane LAPD officers.
Oh my god, the worst.
Yeah. One of them is actually, I think, Vincent D'Onofrio. The other one is a guy whose name I can't remember, who's in, like, a bunch of things and has a kind of cadaver-like face. They have no compunction against using violence for these ends that they seem to have in mind, and they are also trying to prevent Rafe and Angela from solving the crime for reasons that are entirely clear. And in this one kind of, like, outrageous scene, they start shooting at Rafe and Angela inside her car, and then they just light it on fire, and then all Angela can do to save them is what?
Drive off the deck into the river.
Yeah, so she drives a burning car into the ocean, then she has to fire a rifle from inside the car to blast the doors off, and she and Rafe can, like, swim to safety.
Yeah, can I just say, one of the more unbelievable things about this film is how clean that water was.
The movie, by that point, has been going on for nearly 2 hours. We have skipped a lot of the convolutions about Juliette Lewis and Rafe Fiennes' best friend, who's a kind of a weird private eye with, like, lanky hair and...
And also Fate's club promoter boyfriend.
Yeah, all this kind of stuff. We've skipped all that.
And they're all important in their own way.
If people want to watch the movie and be surprised, don't listen to what we're about to talk to. But I feel like we need to describe what happens, because the political charge of the film and actually Angela's significance in the plot is really based around the revelation of what has incited all of this mishigas to happen in the first place.
Okay, you know, I think it's right that Brian points out that this is kind of a spoiler, but, like, it's integral to our discussion of it, is that there's a reason why these cops are such unrelenting killing machines and want to stop these people. The disc that Iris put in Lenny's car that they go to get there contains footage of the police executing, by shooting him in the head, Jericho, the really significant political rapper.
So we've described that there's this one video, which is the brutal rape and murder of a woman. There's another video that we watch at extreme length, which is a stop and frisk where Jericho and his companions get pulled over by these two maniacal cops.
Yeah.
He is complying with the fact that they get him down, kneeling on the ground, and they're holding guns, and they're, you know, speaking to him abusively, and he is responding in a poised, articulate manner, but saying to them, "You're violating my civil rights, right? Yeah. I reject the LAPD and the in the way that they are oppressing the black community." I mean, it's really strong stuff.
Really.
And he's basically triggering this kind of racially charged reaction from them, where they just basically execute him and his friend and shout things like, "This is for all the police review boards that have been, like, trying to stop cops from being able to carry out law and order." And there is just such a charge. I mean, again, it's a science fiction film, so everything that's taken from real life has been intensified.
Yeah, been blown up, yeah.
And it's been given the James Cameron treatment, which is not necessarily naturalistic. But when this movie started to become basically an entire thing that was centered around police brutality, I, for one, did not see where this was coming from. And then, of course, we have a white man and a black woman who are our heroes, and they watch this, and they kind of have different reactions.
What was his reaction?
Well, basically, Rafe knows that it's bad. He's been a former cop himself, but he's mostly concerned with the fact that, because of their knowledge about this, Faith is likely to be in danger. Faith is Juliet Lewis.
Oh, God, yeah, now I understand.
And so he kind of wants to run off to the hotel and save her.
Yeah, they think that the horrible rapes and murders are a way to prevent them from doing anything with this footage.
Like, basically, these two renegade cops who have killed probably the most significant black man in this society don't want this tape to get into the hands of anyone, and they are willing to, you know, kill and destroy anyone so that they can get their hands on this tape. And Angela says to Rafe, and this is where she really comes into her own as a character, she's like, "That tape is bigger than you, it's bigger than me, it's bigger than Faith. This is a tape that could change things. If we can get this out and show this to the world, it can expose the LAPD for the kind of killing force that it really is."
Mm-hmm. "You're gonna get yourself killed for this. Huh? For this toxic waste, bitch!
What the fuck are you doing?
Look, this is your life! Right here, right now. It's real time. You hear me? Real time. Time to get real, not playback. You understand me? She doesn't love you anymore. Maybe she did once, I don't know, but she doesn't now. These are used emotions. It's time to trade them in. Memories were meant to fade, Lenny. They're designed that way for a reason."
And this is where the movie both becomes more interesting and maddening to me, okay? Yeah. Because we get this section where it's all coming down to this New Year's Eve millennium climax at this big nightclub, yeah, where we're about to count down to the year 2000, and Rafe and Angela arrive together. They're all glammed up in their New Year's duds, right? Mm. Rafe goes up into the hotel room to solve the murder and confront Faith and all these other things that, to be honest, I have no interest in describing. We do learn who killed Iris and who the horrible rapist murderer was, and it's not who you would expect, and there's all kinds of back and forth and backstabbings and all these kind of things going on. But while that's happening, Angela is down in the crowd with the revelers, being stalked by these two sadistic cops, with the tape in her hand, trying to get it to the police commissioner.
Yeah, who were told earlier on is this completely unflappable, you know,
He's an upstanding man who believes in true justice and police values and is the very person who's been conducting these review boards to, like, you know, get corruption and brutality out of the force.
Yeah.
He's basically looks like an old white man, but, you know...
Because he is an old white man.
He is an old white man, but he's, like, a kindly old white man.
Yeah.
She can't get the tape in his hands. He's kind of aware of her, but other people are, like, shoving him away in the crowd. She finally gets into this confrontation with the two cops, and here's where the movie has maybe its, like, most charged moment. Those cops, like, go at Angela Bassett, and she fights back.
And the entire crowd as well, on their way to get her.
Yeah, so they're in the middle of this insane, big, reveling crowd. And, I mean, it's not unsignificant, the manner in which Angela Bassett fights against these two cops. Do you remember? So the cops are kind of shooting randomly at her in the crowd. She takes a taser, and she tasers one of them. And then she takes a police baton, and she gets the other one in a chokehold.
And then she, like, handcuffs them to each other.
Yeah, and nearly, you know, asphyxiates him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is in a Hollywood sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
Created by two white people, we have this representation of Angela Bassett, black woman, as this revenging force against these two cops using the very weapons of police brutality, tasers and batons, against the cops.
Hey, I'm into it.
It is such a provocative series of actions and scenes.
Yeah.
Once they've been handcuffed and incapacitated, the rest of the LAPD force comes in and starts beating the shit out of Angela Bassett.
Oh my god, yes.
I mean, we have these images of a whole mob of cops coming in and attacking this woman who is trying to get her own back against the police. And I mean, the charge of this content is insane. I think a disappointing element to it is that while this is all kicking off and the crowd is going berserk, it's up to white police commissioner, whoever, to come in and stop everything and say,
Chief Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah, I've just watched this tape and this woman is innocent and, you know, we're going to investigate this. And basically, the message seems to be the system will somehow self-correct. Yeah. It's all about some bad apples. And, you know, it just takes the white man to step in. I mean, Angela has stepped into the danger zone by bringing this tape in, but it's up to him to save the day. And that's not the most satisfying conclusion. We also have to deal with Rafe up in the hotel room with Juliet. He comes down. He kind of just comes into the tail end of Angela's insane experience.
Oh, you're down here.
and sort of how does it end?
Well, it ends in the traditional unification of the man and woman.
Yeah, so they're going to be taken off to be interviewed separately by the police. But Rafe kind of finally realizes, after understanding that slutty hoe Juliet Lewis was, like, not worth his time, that actually faithful, stalwart, sexy, kung fu driver, waitress mother Angela Bassett is the person he should have been with all along. And he runs to her, and they make out in this crowd as the clock of the millennium is ticking down.
Hey, Lenny, we made it.
I think in 1995, having Angela Bassett and Ralph Fiennes make out as the last kind of image of your movie is still pretty... I mean, at that time, it was definitely quite shocking.
Well, I was just thinking about The Bodyguard. When did that happen?
Probably around the same time, year or two earlier.
Okay, yeah.
Like,
was there any controversy around that?
I'm sure there was from some people, you know?
Losers.
It's significant that Angela Bassett and Rafe have really not had any kind of physical romantic contact up until the very last shot of the movie. It is not presented as a love story between them, and I think it is a failing of the movie that it can't go there until the very end, you know? And I don't know what you think about this, Sean. Like, I kind of get the sense that you really liked Strange Days, just like it assaulted you with so much interesting content and visuals. Is that right?
Well, I just think that's the power of cinema. What it can do is, like, I did feel assaulted, but I liked it.
Okay. I watched this and thought, what a fascinating and amazing...
failure.
I wouldn't say entirely failure, but really film that doesn't totally work. And I was re-editing and rewriting the film in my head, frankly, from Angela Bassett's character's perspective. Yeah. And I thought, how much more interesting if, rather than the huge amount of time devoted to Ralph Fiennes' character and that he was our way into this world, what if Angela, as this working-class woman trying to get by, driving her limo, who has all this history with all these other characters...
And it can wait five tables at once.
What if she starts to get sucked into this world and realize that, like, it's up to her to take down the LAPD and avenge, like, you know, the black community?
Yeah.
All of those things happen in the movie, but the balance of narrative perspective is just... It's calibrated badly, you know. I would say this movie would probably be so much more of a classic and a success if that was the story that it was focused on, rather than Rafe as the kind of freakish pimp.
Well, you know, here's a challenge. Whoever edited that film, to get all the footage and just make it different.
Yeah, possibly. You know, I think there'd probably have to be some reshoots.
I mean, I would love to see... Strange Days 2028.
Yeah, for sure.
That would be good.
Would we still have Angela, or would we have to recast it with somebody else?
We would still have Angela.
Could she have a grown daughter like Lupita or someone like that, and they're like kicking ass together as a mother-daughter team?
Maybe Tiffany Haddish.
That is an excellent idea.
Yeah.
That is great. And Rafe's character has lost his nose in all those years. Yeah, excellent. If you have any interest in sci-fi, political commentary, or frankly just Angela Bassett continuing to be badass, you may well enjoy going and seeking out Strange Days.
Brian, I've loved these three films, even Vampire in Brooklyn. I love when we just completely tear a film to shreds, but you more so than me.
You know, Sean, you as an Angela Bassett stan are in luck in the year 2018. You get two big-budget Angela Bassett appearances coming up very soon. Mission Impossible, and of course, Ryan Coogler's Black Panther.
Which we may have seen by now.
We may have seen by the time you were listening to this, and no doubt we ought to believe the hype, do we think?
Well, listen, before I finish, I gave both Wonder Woman and Thor Ragnarok a go this year, and... Both times, after 10 minutes in each, I was like, what am I doing at a superhero film? I'm sure it's woke as hell, but I'm surely going to have the same realization 10 minutes into Black Panther, being like, oh god, yeah, it's a superhero film.
Listen, I've never seen a superhero film since Batman Returns, I think. But like,
oh, they've changed, my folks. They've changed.
But I am really excited for Black Panther because it just does feel like it's something different. It's certainly at least different in terms of the people that we're seeing on screen. One of them being the Queen, Angela Bassett.
Queen Bee.
Maybe she should play the Queen. What do you think? Queen Elizabeth.
I'm all for colorblind casting.
Well, I mean, I'm sure... I mean, Olivia Colman can't possibly be playing the Queen all the way through to the end of The Crown on Netflix, you know? Okay. Angela Bassett, you are a goddess. May you continue to reign.
Yeah.
Hopefully, every year from now on will be like 1995 all over again.
Yeah.
Speaking of queens... There is someone else that we're about to cover who has another title, a reigning title, and that title is America's Sweetheart.
For some reason, I thought we were doing Barbra Streisand again when you told me that. I was like, what? Didn't we do this?
This woman could power, you know, the entire electrical grid with her 1,000-watt smile. Of course, we are talking about that human ball of energy and charisma whose mouth is about half the size of her face, Julia frickin' Roberts.
I mean, you almost have as many teeth as she does.
From one big mouth person to another.
Big mouth strikes again.
I cannot wait. I cannot wait for us to look at the good, bad, crazy of Julia Roberts in 2 weeks' time. So, Johnny, where can people find us in the interim?
You can find us on Twitter at Broad Appeal Pod, and with our individual Twitter handles, I'm at Sean McGovern X, and Brian's at BA Mullen Speaks. And while you're at it, or just while you're listening right now, just take the phone out of your pocket, okay? You know,
or, you know, the table where it might be lying, whatever, you know.
Put your finger on the click in button, okay? Go to podcasts and give us a 5-star rating.
It's great if it's on Apple Podcasts, if you're an iPhone user, if you're an Android person.
Whatever it is there.
I mean, do you dream of electric sheep? That's my question to you. But, you know, whatever podcast you're using on, if you have the possibility to leave a review for us, please do. Tell your friends. Angela Bassett will appreciate it, and so will we.
Yeah.
We will see you in 2 weeks' time. You know what, Sean? You've always been the prettiest woman to me.
And you've always been Mary Riley to me.
Let's go eat some Mystic Pizza. Yes. We'll see you very soon.
Eat, pray, love. Bye.
Shades drowning the rays of rock. Close your eyes and still see the yellow sun. Feel the earth beneath your feet, reaching to meet the sea, the sky, and I fly higher. Above the ground, beneath the sound that's going round and round and round and round.